Welcome to our second episode of No Worse Off. I'm Emma Gatto.
And I'm Craig Montgomery. I'm a partner in our litigation and restructuring team.
And today we're delighted to be joined by Tom Smith KC, whose reputation in the restructuring space precedes him. Welcome and thank you very much for joining us, Tom.
Thanks for inviting me. It's great to join you.
So today we're going to be discussing some of the recent high-profile restructuring plans and what we can learn from the jurisprudence and hopefully how this can help us shape future plans.
Yes, and Tom has appeared on many of the restructuring plans in recent years and is in fact contributing actively to developing a clearer body of law, with his latest appearances being in front of the Court of Appeal, obviously on Adler, which everyone is talking about, but also in other cases, Aggregate, Prezzo, Fitness First, Virgin Active, Deep Ocean, etc., etc. So to kick off, Tom, you've been at the centre of many disputes and challenges that we've seen over recent restructuring plans. What do you make of the overall state of the jurisprudence? Do you feel we now have clearer guidance from the courts to shape future plans, or are there still many unanswered questions and gaps to fill?
I think we do have much clearer guidance from the courts now. There are one or two gaps still to fill, I think, going forward. But the basic principles, particularly post the Court of Appeal decision in Adler, are now reasonably clear. I think most importantly, the test for cross-class cramdown has now been clarified. Cross-class cramdown is perhaps the most important feature of restructuring plans. And I think the test for that is now reasonably settled coming out of the Court of Appeal decision. Prior to that, there was this question about whether in the context of restructuring plans, the court has to get involved with the question of whether or not it's the best plan or the fairest plan. I think post-Adler, the Court of Appeals made it clear that that is a question. The question of substantive fairness is one which the court will need to get engaged in. But also, importantly, I think the court's given us now a framework, a reference point as to how we apply that test and the way in which it is to be applied is by reference to how creditors would be treated in the relevant alternatives. So I think on those fundamental points, there is now some welcome clarity from the courts.
Yes, and fairness, Tom, has been really a key focus of the courts in recent restructuring plans. And we've certainly had clarifications from Adler and the Court of Appeal that RPs are really different beasts to schemes, although the same principles do apply when it comes to cross-class cramdown. Because of the loss of veto for the dissenting classes, the court has to have a much more involved role in determining fairness. And we'll talk about the horizontal test. But let's turn to our first topic, which is the notion of compromise. So what does a compromise really mean in a plan? And in particular, one of the interesting questions is, what consideration, if any, do you need to give to out-of-the-money creditors? Can you just compromise them without giving them any value at all? And can that value be nominal, just to get over the sort of no worse off test? We've had some guidance on this, haven't we, from Adler, Tom. Do you want to tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a really important point. Ironically, it didn't really arise directly for decision on the facts of the Adler case itself, but the Court of Appeal nonetheless took the opportunity to express its views on the point. And it's obviously an absolutely key question for restructuring plans going forwards, given that, as you say, we can cram down out of the money creditors and shareholders. Now, in Adler, the Court of Appeals said that because the legislation for restructuring plans uses the same terminology as of compromise and arrangement as has historically been used for schemes of arrangement, that in effect transplanted across some of the case law applicable to schemes, including a requirement that an arrangement can't involve a pure expropriation of rights. And that's a principle that had effectively been developed in the context of schemes of arrangement. And essentially what the Court of Appeal said was because that same term had been used in relation to the restructuring plan legislation, that meant the same principle applies to restructuring plans. I think for my part, it's highly questionable whether that is in fact right. There's a number of points to my mind which point in the other direction. I think first, it doesn't seem to me all that likely that Parliament in fact had this point in mind when using the same terminology. If you look at the explanatory materials, for example, relating to the introduction of RPs, they don't mention this point at all. And it might be said it's a bit unrealistic to think Parliament intended positively to transplant this across. I think, you know, more substantively, it also leads to what might be thought to be a very odd result, because was under Part 26A restructuring plans. Of course, you can cram down out of the money creditors without giving them anything. You can exercise the cram down power in those circumstances. And indeed, you can entirely exclude them from voting at all on the plan. And it seems somewhat odd that if that was the intention of Parliament in relation to excluding people from voting in relation to the exercise of the cram down power, that you nonetheless have to give something to out of the money creditors, shareholders, almost as some kind of consolation payment. I think that is a sort of odd result that might be said to lead to a somewhat incoherent position. And then thirdly, I think you're going to come to this point, but there's also a question, well, what amount do you have to give them? I mean, the Court of Appeal said it's a modest amount. I think it's a legitimate question to ask, well, what does that mean? And how do you go about measuring what a modest amount is? How do you advise clients preparing restructuring plans on what it is they do have to give out of the money creditors and shareholders? So I think this is a live question. It may be we haven't heard the last on this point.
Yes, look, I agree. It does seem entirely inconsistent to be able to exclude a class entirely from voting and yet require them to have something given to them, some value as part of the plan. It's interesting you talk of consolation payment. As you say, the court mentioned a modest amount. In my mind, modest is more than nominal. But what is it? Certainly it's a question we've been asking ourselves and we'll be asking ourselves so going forward. What do you think of it,
Well, the test, as Tom said, is a bit vague, isn't it? I mean, is there any minimum level? So on aggregate that Tom and I were both involved in, there was the out-of-the-money creditors were offered €200,000 collectively, which sounds like a reasonable amount, but across, you know, more than €1 billion of debt, it's really very insignificant. So would €1 have been enough? And this is all premised, as you say, on the irrelevant creditors being out of the money, i.e. they get nothing in the relevant alternative. So it's not about ensuring the creditors are definitely better off. It's a kind of consolation payment. And at what level is a modest consideration modest? And at what level is it expropriatory? And €200,000 is clearly modest in the circumstances, but it's not nothing. So in appropriate circumstances, might you want to give, you know, some sort of instrument to such creditors that doesn't sit on the balance sheet but has some value if the company's valuation turns out to be too pessimistic? And that's the sort of thing that the opposing creditors were contending for in aggregate, but ultimately the 200,000 was considered adequate. So I think we'll continue to see companies push the boundary a little bit on that.
Certainly an area where more clarification is needed going forward. Turning to our next topic, fairness. What does it mean in practice and what will the court be looking at in restructuring plans? So we've had very well established tests in schemes, the rationality test, essentially where the court looks at whether an intelligent and honest creditor and member of the class might reasonably approve the scheme. Now that test is still relevant outside of cross-class cramdown and for assenting classes, but what we now know is that in a cross-class cramdown scenario, when we're asking the court to exercise that jurisdiction, the court needs to go further than that and needs to look at the horizontal comparison. So, Tom, can you tell us a little bit more about why it's so important to go that step further and what the horizontal comparison test involves?
So the horizontal comparison essentially concerns looking at the relative treatment of creditors with each other. So it's looking at the way in which classes of creditors and individual creditors are treated relative to each other under the plan, and specifically whether one class of creditor is treated in a way that's better to other creditors. And the term horizontal reflects the fact you're looking at their treatment as between each other. Now, it's a very important issue when it comes to cross-class cramdown and when the court's looking at the question of fairness, because one important aspect of the question of fairness, fair treatment under the plan, is whether creditors are being treated in a way that's fair as between themselves. Now, the court, it's clear, following Adler, will normally approve a plan if the relative treatment of different creditor groups reflects their treatment in the relevant alternative. So if you've got a creditor who would have priority in the relevant alternative, it's fair to give them priority under the plan. If, on the other hand, all the creditors would be treated in the same way in the relevant alternative, then your starting point under the plan is to treat them in the same way. Now, if you have a situation where creditors would be treated in the same way in the relevant alternative, then it's clearly necessary to show a good reason for departing from that treatment under the plan. You need to show a good reason of some kind as to why you're not simply following the way in which they would be treated in the relevant alternative. And the real issue with the Adler plan, ultimately, is that the company couldn't show any good reason for treating the unsecured bondholders in a different way under the plan as compared with the way in which they would have been treated in the relevant alternative, which would simply have been a pari passu distribution. So ultimately, the horizontal comparator was the reason why the Adler plan failed. I mean, this concept of horizontal comparator, and indeed the term horizontal comparator, has been a familiar feature in relation to CVAs. We've been familiar with it in that context for a number of years, but now it quite clearly also applies to the test for cross-class cramdown under a restructuring plan.
And I'm interested in sort of when you can depart from this pari passu treatment in the scenario where creditors would be treated pari passu in the relevant alternative. The court in Adler gave some helpful examples, for example, trade creditors being treated differently because they're necessary for the business, new money providers being treated differently and given a priority, which all makes sense. So do we think we're limited to those scenarios? And what's a good reason, essentially, for differential treatment? What guidance do we have?
I think this is actually one of the most important parts of the Court of Appeal's judgment. What the Court of Appeal made clear is that although the fairness of treatment of creditors and shareholders is to be assessed by reference to their position in the relevant alternative, that is a starting point. It's not a rigid and invariable rule. And the Court of Appeal made quite clear, as you say, that there may be circumstances in which there will be good reason to depart from that treatment. You're not absolutely stuck with an inflexible position of having to treat creditors in exactly the same way they would be treated in the relevant alternative. I don't think there is any close category of cases as to what might constitute a good reason for these purposes. Common examples will clearly be payment of trade creditors and employees in order to preserve value by allowing a business to continue as a going concern. There might be other examples where you have to make a payment to a particular creditor in order to preserve value for the greater good. I don't see there's any necessary closed category in that regard. It will depend on the circumstances of particular cases. And also the obtaining of new money. It's quite clear from what the Court of Appeals said that it's perfectly possible to grant priority security to someone who's granting new money, and that might be an existing creditor, in order to bring in that value and that liquidity for the benefit of the state as a whole. There may be other examples too. I don't think this is a situation where there's any closed category at the moment.
So, Tom, you raised that point about new money, and this was a point that came up in Adler in the context of elevation structures. So it's reasonably common these days where new money is coming in from existing creditors to have a provision that if you provide new money, you're also entitled to elevate some of your existing debt, i.e. allow it to benefit from the priority security. And the reason why that's obviously attractive for the creditors, the reason why it's attractive for the company is because you can effectively then make the new money cheaper. And so the cost of the new money is not necessarily the cost of the company, but a cost to the other creditors who are not being elevated. And the court explained that elevation would not be justified if the opportunity to provide the new money was not in reality available to all creditors on an equal and non-coercive basis. And we've always been careful in a scheme context to offer the opportunity to participate in new money to all creditors. But in a scheme context, that's to avoid breaking classes, because you want to make sure you're treating all creditors similarly if you want them to be in the same class. That's less important in a restructuring plan because of the availability of cross-class cramdown. And so this is a different point, a fairness point, as to whether the court will sanction a plan which provides for elevation, where there's an actual or perceived failure to justify the differential treatment of the elevated existing debt compared to the non-elevated existing debt. And it was also a feature of the aggregate case, but it wasn't challenged in that case, so it went through there. In that case, the junior debt was being written off, so it was less of an issue. You didn't have people elevating junior debt ahead of senior debt. In another case where there is junior debt which is in the money. And whereas commonly the case, there are cross holdings between senior and junior debt. So you have senior creditors providing new money and elevating junior debt. That's something that might be challenged, I guess. And there's also a valuation question, as such plans will often say that if you advance, say, £1 of new money, you can elevate £1 of existing debt. But there's usually very little attempt to justify why that's the appropriate ratio and why it wouldn't be 50 pence of existing debt for £1 of new money, for example. So that's something that might come under greater scrutiny.
I think they will. And I think the Court of Appeal was right to flag this as an issue that does need to be given thought and consideration in relation to the structuring of plans going forward. I agree. I mean, I think there's essentially two points here underlying this topic. The first is a fairness point, almost a due process point, in ensuring that all of the relevant creditors do have a proper opportunity to participate in the new money if they wish to do so. We know from practice there can be issues around that, around the ability people have constitutionally to participate, around the timescales for doing so. I think that definitely remains a live issue that needs to be looked at carefully when a plan's being put together. The second, as you rightly mentioned, is a more substantive point as to the amount of value that is attributed to the new money. And I think that is a very important issue, certainly when it comes to cross-class cram-down, because it goes fundamentally to the question of the fair allocation of benefits under the plan, which, as we know from the Court of Appeal in Adler, is something the court will have to look at. So if you have, for example, a plan where the senior and junior creditors are both in the money in the relevant alternative, they would both get some return in the relevant alternative, but the seniors are being given the opportunity to put in new money, then the question of what value is being given in return for that new money would be highly relevant, in my view. It would go exactly to the question of the fair distribution of benefits between the seniors and the juniors. And there would be a question as to whether too much value is being given in return for the new money at the expense of the junior creditors, as well as those senior creditors who do not or who are unable to participate in the new money. If you have a situation where the new money is so rich that in effect all the value is coming through that, then I think that would be a legitimate ground of objection by junior creditor. So I think short answer is this is an important point that will need to be looked at carefully going forwards.
Yes, I agree. And inevitably, in every case, there's going to be so many different ways to slice the pie and share the recoveries and the restructuring surplus among the creditors. And I think what we're seeing now is, and what the court clarified in Adler, is that when cross-class cram-down is involved, unlike in schemes, and you mentioned it at the start, Tom, the court will be looking to see if there could be a fairer plan. And it's not enough to say this plan is fair. How literally should this be taken, do we think? Does every restructuring plan presented to a court need to be the fairest of them all?
I don't think so. I think the court doesn't need to look for the fairest available in all the circumstances, but I think it does need to be satisfied there's a justifiable reason for not choosing the fairer plan if there is one. One interesting question is whether you engage in that exercise at all if the dissenting classes are out of the money. And it seems to be pretty clear from Virgin Active and from the subsequent cases like Aggregate, for example, that such creditors' views carry very little weight. So there is a question as to whether they have standing to raise such points at all. Where do you think we stand on that now, Tom?
I mean, on the out-of-the-money creditors point, I agree that the law, I think, post-Virgin Active, which was apparently approved in Adler and cases like Aggregate, that the position is fairly clear that out-of-the-money creditors have no standing, little or no standing, I think was the phrase used in Virgin Active itself, and that their views carry little or no weight. I mean, you can say that's somewhat of a purist's view, but I mean, I think there is a sort of logical and sound basis for that, because once the court has come to the conclusion that the most likely situation absent the plan is a situation where these creditors wouldn't get any return, then it seems to follow from that they don't have standing, they don't have a basis to object to the plan itself. Now, the question of the extent to which the court has to assess whether the plan is the fairest one is an interesting one. And I think this is one of those areas probably where the boundaries still are going to need to be worked out a little bit in practice. I don't think at the moment we have a bright line test for sort of working out what parts of a plan the court can get involved in assessing the fairness of and what parts really go beyond its remit. Clearly, it's not possible or realistic for the court to ask in relation to each and every term of a plan whether that term is the fairest possible term. If one was going to go down that route, you have a sort of endless exercise of the court sort of getting involved in the actual drafting and formulation of plans, which is clearly not realistic. It seems to me that the question really has to be focused on the overarching allocation of economic benefits and burdens under the plan. That's a substantive question of fairness for the court. And then there may be a sort of question on top of that of whether other terms are obviously unfair or objectionable. But I don't see in that context that the court can really start asking whether individual terms are the fairest, or if you change the drafting a little bit, it becomes fairer. That would be unrealistic.
Where you have creditors who are out of the money, as we saw in aggregate, for example, there was a challenge to valuation and reasonable alternative from one of the groups of dissenting creditors there that was found to be out of the money, and that used up 4 days of court time, and obviously because of that delayed the sanction of the scheme for several months. Do you think we'll see more use of the Section 901(c)(4) orders? So this is where the court can decide at the convening stage that a creditor is out of the money and therefore they effectively take no further part in the process, they don't vote. Or would that just shift the burden of all of that litigation, the 4 days of dispute, to the earlier stage with no real overall benefit?
Possibly we might see more use of 901(c)(4) orders. Potentially, they're obviously very useful. I think that there's a mechanism that one has in the legislation to disenfranchise creditors right at the outset of the process. It is a very useful one. And as you say, it can lead to a situation where you can have a much more confined process going forwards. I think the issue with 901(c)(4) orders, to my mind, is essentially a procedural one. It's obviously necessary, if you're going to go down that route, to serve the relevant valuation evidence and probably the other evidence as well on the relevant creditors well in advance of the convening hearing so that they have a proper opportunity to challenge it, and if necessary, you can have a debate, an argument about this at the convening hearing. In practice, one knows that that can be very challenging to achieve without a long lead-up time to the restructuring plan. It effectively means you have to get that evidence in place at a much earlier stage than would otherwise be the position. There can also be difficulties with serving, giving notice of it to the creditors. I think this is challenging potentially where you've got a large and disparate group of creditors and shareholders to engage with. And it's perhaps telling that the one case where this has really been used was the Smile Telecoms case. And in that case, the creditors concerned were a relatively small group of financial institutions. I think that there was only about 7 of them or so. In that sort of case, you can see it potentially working. I think where you're trying to disenfranchise many thousands of shareholders in a public listed company, for example, it would just be unworkable. So I see it as being a sort of practical impediment, really.
And just final thoughts on the topic of fairness. Clearly, what we've talked about will involve the court making detailed commercial appreciations of the transaction, which previously in the world of schemes was something that was really left to for the appreciation of the creditors. The judges didn't want to substitute themselves for the judgment of the creditors. Now the court in Adler is expressly saying it must engage with the underlying commercial issues. Are we moving, do we think, towards more of a sort of interventionist judge, a bit like in Chapter 11s, when the judge likes to tweak the plans more like the US? And do we think that the judges are well equipped to make that kind of commercial appreciations in the UK?
Well, I think judges are clearly able to understand commercial issues and to make judgments on complex issues of sort of rival valuations and all that sort of thing. So I don't think the complexity is an issue. And we see that in litigation all the time with, you know, rival expert evidence, etc. I mean, as Tom said earlier, that doesn't mean the court becomes a negotiating party on every term. It's still one side putting forward their position and the other side putting forward their position and the judge effectively deciding between them. The challenge in the plan context is that time is short because you don't have full disclosure processes and there's no equality of arms in that sense. The company has the whip hand. And the courts, as we have seen in Aggregate and McDermott, for example, are doing what they can to treat plans more like litigation, with giving more time before hearings, encouragement to disclose the data on which models are based, for example, longer hearings to allow for, you know, proper cross-examination and closing submissions off the back of that. So I think the lesson for parties, whether you're the company promoting the plan or someone looking to challenge the plan, is that you need to be on a litigation footing from day one and anticipating whether there might be opposition.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think the court in the restructuring plan context is inevitably going to have to make these sort of assessments, and I think it will be able to do so. I don't see myself as it really involving the court exercising commercial judgments. I think rather what the court is doing is assessing whether the plan is substantively fair by reference to treatment of creditors in the relevant alternative, and whether there's a good reason, if any, for departing from that treatment under the terms of the plan itself. I think there's sort of two areas which may be of interest sort of going forwards in terms of how this develops. The first, I think, is whether the court does become more interventionist in relation to plans. At the moment, they're sort of presented by the plan company almost on a take it or leave it basis. The plan company comes to the court and says, this is the plan, it's fair. And the court is really sort of asked to make a binary choice. Is it fair or is it unfair? I can see a world developing. I don't think we're necessarily quite there yet, but I can see a world developing where the court may look for a third way in relation to some of these, and the court may end up concluding that it thinks parts of the plan are fair, but it may think part is unfair, and it may say to the plan company that its determination is that it's not prepared to sanction the plan in its particular form, but it would sanction it if an amendment or modification was made. I think that would clearly be a departure from the way in which we've looked at schemes in the past, but I wouldn't be surprised if that's ultimately where we end up.
That's interesting, because we saw in McDermott that was potentially a weakness of the restructuring plan system, is that whereas in the Netherlands under the WOA system, there was an ability with the appointment of a restructuring expert to effectively iterate the plan to get to something that was the court perceived was fairer for everyone. As you say here, it was very much sort of take it or leave it. And so the ability of the company to maneuver at that stage, once you're through the vote, is quite limited.
Thank you very much, Tom and Craig. I think that's all we've got time for today. In our next episode, Tom, you'll be joining us again. Thank you. And we'll be going more into some of the practical implementation points and timetabling of restructuring plans, which are linked into some of the issues we've talked about around fairness, etc. So we look forward to seeing you again soon, Tom. And thank you very much for listening.